Hello, everyone, and welcome to Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. I'm your host, Nathan Fletcher, a.k.a. Uncle Nene. We have a great show today. We're going to talk about science fiction movies that get it right, that get the science right. So Interstellar, The Martian, Her. We're going to talk about AI, Ex Machina. We're going to talk about Gattaca and Tron. It's going to be a lot of fun. My guest today is a gentleman who is a global executive leader with more than 25 years experience helping Fortune 100 companies like ExxonMobil, Cisco, Microsoft, HP. And he is also a huge nerd, loves science fiction, and sits on the board of a science and engineering school. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about that. Welcome to the show, Dan Fricker. How are you doing, Dan?
Hello. This is the sound of my voice.
Great to have you here, Dan. I really appreciate it. First, tell the little folks about the board that you sit on. That you were talking about how that's interesting, how everyone there is into science fiction too.
Yes. So I think there's that point in every person's life as you grow up of like what path you take. And I have always loved sci-fi, everything from Twilight Zone to obscure movies. So I currently sit, it's my seventh year, being on the career advisory board at the University of Minnesota within the College of Science and Engineering. So I'm constantly being surrounded by a bunch of PhDs, being the dumbest guy in the room. But I will tell you, for the seventh year in a row, we typically have a dinner after the board meeting. And the number one topic we talk about is what TV shows, films, whatever, streaming gets the science right. Yeah. And it is a hysterical conversation because, you know, you can have proper PhDs get into some pretty interesting arguments. And I know we're going to maybe touch on like movies like Interstellar and The Martian, in which you've got theories that are being disproven or modified because of, you know, the Webb telescope and, you know, yeah. Is it real, is it not? But it's I think that's the point of a good film, especially a good sci-fi film.
Yes.
So very excited to be here today.
Yes, I love that. I would like to first ask you a question. For when you started early on in life, if you can think back to your childhood or at some point in your development, you first fell in love with sci-fi. What was that movie or TV show that you were obsessed with that just really grabbed you?
So I actually thought about this. So I grew up on the north side of Chicago, right? And there was WFLD TV channel 32, right? And so before you had actual cable shows that would have like Nick at Night and everything else. So this, obviously this wasn't one of the big three ABC, NBC, CBS shows. So they used to show the old Twilight Zones, the
yes.
old Star Treks. They yeah. would show like BBC, so you would get your Doctor Who's and, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, I think not only was I attracted to, you know, those particular shows and those vignettes, which I still think today, having a daughter that's, you know, teenager and everything else, like, we will talk about sci-fi. But, of course, she's now got this whole other kind of genre. And so we actually do Comic-Cons together. And so every Great. Time she's confused, she points it out. I'm like, oh, I think that's from Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. It's an episode, you know, from the Twilight Zone. With
yes.
You know, so she just kind of lets me go off. So I think it was those types of roots. And then coupled by, yeah, I was kind of that first VHS generation. And, you know, if a friend was like, you have to see this movie, and it was like The Thing, you know, like that's what we would do, and it would be awesome. And, you know, yeah. and this even touched on, you know, as a kid, especially also growing up kind of in the shadow of like Star Wars, you know, like obviously it came out, but then it got re-released in the early 80s. And I tried to get my daughter to watch the original Tron, and she didn't last more than probably 20 minutes just from the pacing and everything else. But
yes.
like, you know, that movie was definitely in my top three as a kid.
Okay.
And it wasn't until years later that I realized just how, like, how prophetic of a film that was, whether
yeah.
they meant to or not.
yeah. Yeah. You know, perfect timing. I think let's go ahead and check out this clip, and we can talk over this because this is kind of a long clip, but it's. Turn the volume down a little bit there. But, you know, this is the scene where he gets, gets digitized. And I think it's fascinating because it's going line by line, the way that pixels were processed. And when you downloaded a picture, it would come in sometimes line by line in the early 90s, you know? And so even back then when they did this, this was state-of-the-art graphics back then.
I would actually argue something with Insta. I mean, but how is this fundamentally different? When you're thinking about some of the agentic AI tools with, like, Claude, for example, being able to take how you write, how you communicate, and replicate that in such a way that it is a version of you. Right, so if you're thinking about being the personification of being like physically pulled into this digital realm, right? And this whole concept that we're looking at right here, like no one was really thinking this way, or maybe just like the kids from Northside Chicago, you know, Bill Gates. So like the idea of like fighting for the users, the fact that you have kind of corporations, you know, like trying to profit off of users' information. You know, you're talking about cybersecurity and being able to kind of hack systems and take them over and then the protections of it. And of course, you know, this was also the first film that showed Pac-Man before Pac-Man came out.
Yeah.
So they actually showed a Pac-Man.
That's a great point. Yeah, I think it's interesting. What is interesting about Tron is it really explores concepts of consciousness and how can you transfer someone's consciousness. Is our consciousness just the way we talk and the way we walk and the way we act? If so, you know, then how do you capture that? Way before we talked about AI, it was talking about this form of, you know, what is consciousness? And I found that to be fascinating. They were already exploring that in Tron.
I'm almost angry that I didn't do more research ahead of this podcast about what really inspired the writers to, you know, again, just like, I know people actually employ physicists and futurists to be on certain film sets. You see this with like Minority Report and the aforementioned Interstellar and, you know, but they just got so much right with that film. And, you know, I also love the fact that they actually filmed it in black and white. So a lot of the stuff that you see is essentially like, you know, hand done, or if not, you know, or like early computer graphics.
Yeah. So, yeah. Amazing. I thought it stands up pretty well. You know, you can always tell some of those movies that were done back then, they hold up really well over time, like Star Trek movies and with miniatures, those types of things looked really great. And I think Tron did, it holds up, you know, of course, 2001, Kubrick's work is, of course, amazing. But some of those movies looks still to this day, when you watch it, the special effects don't take you out of it. You know, you're still into the story. And I think that's special. You know, I want to go on to AI because, of course, AI is a big topic of conversation these days. Its development is incredible. The rate at which it is increasing is incredible. I want to show a clip from Her, a movie with Joaquin Phoenix. Very interesting because this scene that I'm going to show is when he first uploads it and he has his first conversation. I want to play it without us talking over it because it's interesting, especially if you think about how we interact with AI today. And this was done, I think, about 15 years ago.
It was filmed in 2012, came out in 2013.
Yeah, so pretty incredible. So let's take a look.
Hello, I'm here.
Oh. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm well. How's everything with you?
Pretty good, actually. It's really nice to meet you.
Oh, it's nice to meet you too. Oh, what do I call you? Do you have a name?
Yes. Samantha.
Lily, where'd you get that name from?
I gave it to myself, actually.
How come?
Because I like the sound of it. Samantha.
I think, isn't that great? Isn't that great? I think, what does it make you think of compared to where things are today and how things are developing pretty quickly in that space? What does it make you think of?
Oh, there's several things that spring to mind. You know, again, because this wasn't the first film that kind of prophesies that we are going to be in front of our machines, we're going to interact with our machines in a completely different way. You know, you even to a certain extent get a little bit of that from Star Trek, like both in the movies and the films, where they're like, oh, how quaint that you're using a keyboard, you know, like, you know, and how Scarlett Johansson is interacting, you're now seeing that today. And in fact, the thing that I noted was when that film was not only written and shot and came out in 2012, 2013, that was 2 years before the Ashley Madison hack. And there were two things that came out with the Ashley Madison hack. Number one was, you know, the personal identification information of users came out. But what came out was about 90% approximately of the women or the, you know, were fake, were Gen 1 bots that were essentially interacting with, you know, presumably, you know, men to essentially, you know, buy a user license so that they can, you know, be on the website. I think you're just seeing that now increase exponentially. And I don't think we've spent enough time to really think about the ramifications of a generation where face-to-face interactions are becoming more rare. As a matter of fact, to kind of tie this back to the career advisory board work at the University of Minnesota, you know, I mean, what we're looking to do is improve the career outcomes of, well, because I want to be clear, it's this, the College of Science and Engineering, it's not the whole University of Minnesota, but how do you improve employable outcomes for science students, right? And so if you get a typical science students in physics or astrophysics and you ask them questions about their research, they will go on and on and on. You ask them, tell me about yourself, you know, like Spock.
That really stumps them. That really stumps them. Yeah.
It's serious. Like when Spock was being asked, like, how do you feel? And it just, you know.
Yeah.
So we are trying very deliberate steps on getting them to be able to tie their research and break it down so that they can talk to Luddites like myself around how they're using advanced tools, how they're using, you know, different types of techniques, testing their hypothesis to kind of improve the interaction. But this is also the first generation that we're seeing that were home during the COVID pandemic.
Right.
That essentially, I mean, there's some pretty good research out there that the social development that you see with the current, you know, cadre of students that are graduating with bachelor's, some of their master's, just don't have the same level of social skills.
Right.
And then you get jobs. You have to interact with people.
Yeah.
And in some regards, interacting with the machine is almost easier. And well, I think
there's less at risk, right? So if you're interacting with some form of intelligence that is not a person, then there's less risk. And so it feels safer because you're not going to hurt anybody's feelings. And I think that, you know, I always joke about, you know, when I was young, if I wanted to talk to a girl, I had to pick up a phone and call her house, talk to her parents and ask permission. Can I please speak to Stephanie? This is Nathan. I know her from school. You know, that's what we had to do. There's a courage that requires that today kids don't get to experience taking that risk, taking that courage. And so then they end up there an adult and they're full of anxiety because they haven't built up any of that resilience. And it's challenge that, you know, I'm glad you're working, you know, at the school you're at to help overcome, because it is one of the drawbacks of AI, but I digress. So I wanted to go into Ex Machina because there's a clip there that's pretty interesting. The premise of the movie, for those who don't know at home, the premise of the movie is a brilliant inventor invents a walking, talking AI robot. And under the guise of hiring a coder, brings him on. But his real goal is to just see if this guy can tell if his robot is human or AI. And so in this scene, he is confronted with the fact that he was brought on just to test AI and not actually be a coder. So it's interesting, but I'll go ahead and play that clip.
You feel stupid, but you really shouldn't, because proving an AI is exactly as problematic as you said it
was. What was the real test?
You. Ava was a rat in a maze, and I gave her one way out. To escape, she'd have to use self-awareness, imagination, manipulation, sexuality, empathy, and she did. Now, if that isn't true AI, what the fuck is?
So my only function was to be someone she could use to escape?
Yeah.
And you didn't select me because I'm good at coding?
No. Well, no. I mean, you're okay. You're even pretty good, but...
You selected me based on my search engine inputs.
They showed a good kid.
With no family.
With a moral compass.
And of course, at the, you know, as the movie goes, a spoiler alert, she, you know, conspires to kill the inventor and escapes and all that. What do you think about, you know, science fiction and as it relates to real science? I've been seeing a lot of kind of high level, super smart people, way smarter than me, talk about how they are starting to see some of those LLMs, those AI models, fabricate things, lie, you know, to, you know, and at what point, right, do we know if we're being lied to? Do we know, you know, is there some concern there of dishonesty, and when will we lose control of it? You know, it's not just science fiction now. There is a legitimate concern. We can't tell video that is generated from real video. So, you know, what point when we ask AI a question, is it not going to rely on information we've provided it, and it's going to make up things? And, you know, what are your kind of thoughts on that?
I think there's so many examples in film and TV. I mean, you can, you know, if you look at films recently like Mickey 17, if you look at even Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner that came out, in which you had to take this like really sophisticated test to figure out, is this a human or a replicant?
Right.
So right. You continue to see, you know, if you could go to Star Trek Next Generation, like, would you have Data, and whether or not Data is sentient, you know?
Right.
And when do you cross that line? And what I thought was interesting with Mickey 17 just came out, relatively speaking, is when you have humans that know that this is a person that has been essentially cloned, and they have this person essentially do the most difficult task, which usually results in the demise of the person, but that's okay because he's just going to be replicated again, even though he remembers all the kind of the before and even the after. I think there isn't a great answer to this question, but I will tell you this. Every war demonstrates how innovation gets employed, right? You have the Maxim machine gun in World War One. It takes multiple years for generals to realize that attacking a fixed position head on is a bad idea when you have someone that can spit out, you know, 1,000 rounds a minute.
Right.
You have this current war in Ukraine, and it has become the AI drone war.
Right.
Right. And, you know, we saw this with, you know, if drones kind of really set the stage in the previous, you know, war in Iraq, where you have, and you still, by the way, you still have people flying these things in Las Vegas and other places, you know, essentially dropping bombs on individuals. What happens when you give the machine the ability to decide?
Right.
And now you're starting to get into James Cameron T2. Yeah. So it is an important question that is no longer just science fiction. I think this is an important question that, you know, I mean, I'll give you an example right now in the practical world. So about a year and a half ago, the European Union passed a law that basically forbids companies from making decisions on selection of people by just utilizing AI, right? That there has to be some kind of human interaction on how I hire you.
Okay.
And you actually have to document,
right?
You know, to also show that if you're employing these AI tools, as you alluded to earlier, a lot of these AI tools, I have a meager data science background, but I mean, it's literally just like a parabola. It's like, you know, up to over three. Like it's
right.
You know, most of the current Gen 1 AI systems you see today are just following the patterns based on your structured, unstructured data.
Yeah.
And it, if you, and in your defense, if you don't know that you have bias or unconscious bias, all the AI is going to do is just exacerbate the problem.
Right.
So the law that was passed in Europe was really about trying to create at least some type of moral boundaries, because they know that the cat's already out of the bag. The AI systems are already out there. And you're seeing this in the job hunt market today.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, one of the reasons why it's getting more and more difficult for people to get jobs, quite frankly, because you have AI systems shooting off the resumes and AI systems looking at the resumes. But only 40% of people are even using AI to tweak their resumes.
Right.
So I know we kind of bounce between getting selected, but that's here and now today as a job, or potentially a system that becomes sentient and it has an impact on human beings.
Right.
And I think that clip that you showed, you know, I mean, I will tell you one of the scarier things that are going on is some of the stuff you're seeing out of China, in which they're using all sorts of biometric information. So if you're a worker in a factory, you know, just like you and I are talking right now, like you have different energy levels, you know, and instead of just recording your output for the day, it's starting to detect how do you select workers based on your manufacturing floor and those that are seeing suboptimal metrics by using all this kind of wearable tech. Hmm. So now they can incorporate that in their hiring practices. So what does that do? That potentially is biased against gender. That is potential biased against age because, you know.
Right.
And, you know, now that kind of bleeds into your Gattacas of the world in which you just walk in, put your finger on the little sensor, and it's like you're hired to fire.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think you're spot on. I think there's a lot of peril ahead on the road that if we're not careful, we can go down. And, you know, it's one of the things I love about science fiction is it's always able to explore that and talk about it in a way that makes us think. And I think that that's great. You mentioned Gattaca. I wanted to show this clip. It sets up great the premise of the movie. And then we can talk about that because there is, especially in the area of cloning and genetics, there are some real world things that are happening that are pretty incredible. So let's take a look.
I was conceived in the Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. They used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability, early fatal potential, life expectancy, 30.2 years.
So the premise of that movie, obviously, is that when you're born, they pretty much know exactly how long you're going to live and all your medical conditions. And science is getting to a place where we're getting close to that. We're not there yet, but we're getting pretty close to it. And in the area of cloning, they already brought back the direwolf. That has already happened after it was extinct. They brought it back. And theoretically, there would be nothing preventing them from bringing back, say, Albert Einstein. If they had his DNA, they could genetically clone him and bring back. So why would you have a regular baby when you could have Albert Einstein as your baby? The same genetic material. We're entering into that phase. And although human cloning is illegal, it doesn't mean that it will always be. And so, you know, kind of your thoughts on that side of genetics and cloning and anything that, you know, you think on that.
That film I saw in college, right? So again, number one, I think stylistically, when you look at the film, I think it holds up very well.
Yes,
you
know, absolutely.
They do a ton of practical effects. Anyone that is not a Gen Xer that's younger, Gattaca is always in the top 10, like you have to see this. And what I remind them is it came out at a time in the mid to late 90s. You know, if you're my age, like, you have to remember from 1990 to 2000, even just doing DNA checks on, you know, to fight crime, you know, like,
it was new.
It was completely new. Yeah. It was very expensive. Yep. It wasn't until the early 2000s that you had the technology in such a way that, I mean, if, spoiler alert for the film that came out, you know, 20 plus years ago, like, it was an eyelash that essentially caught one of the characters.
Right.
And that's what you see in forensic crime today, which, you know, multiple shows there. So I think that movie predicts not only crime fighting using.
Yep. Absolutely, you know, it does. Yeah.
I think if you look at the 23andMe bankruptcy and kind of the implications for all those people that thought they, you know, they want to know about themselves, right? They want to know about maybe their family lineage and possibly even use their DNA to help fight certain genetic disorders, be it Parkinson's or whatever. And now you have these notifications going out saying, please delete your data.
Right.
Because what happens if your genetic information goes into some nefarious ways to either have some adverse reaction to you?
Right.
And, you know, one of the questions that comes down to is like, what happens if a healthcare company finds out about you and determines that you have a 99% probability of X, Y, like, do you get declined healthcare insurance? You know, like, film that comes out in the 90s, again, we talked about Tron predicting a dozen or so things. Gattaca, like, when you kind of break down the core elements, I mean, it is here and now for us today.
Absolutely. You know, you bring a great theory is what happens when we're using a AI LLM to scan everybody's genetic material and then decide what their insurance carriage is based on that and whether or not they can afford it, you know, go to the next level, right? If our AI is checking our health and our genetic material and its overall goal is to help us, what's to say if it doesn't start lying to us about what we should eat and what we should not eat so that our health gets better? You know, there's really some implications there that I think are fascinating. Gattaca was great about talking about the genetic side of it. And, you know, it's kind of all converging now. If you, you know, get into the AI and the genetic and the cloning the capability, you know, I think one of the things that it talks about more of kind of, I think the Matrix talked about it, but, you know, the idea of artificial wombs, you know, if we, you know, instead of having babies in the traditional manner, if you can just have your baby, you know, grown in an artificial womb, it's much safer for everybody. But then what happens? Is that a life yet? Is it in the property of a, you know, there's a lot of interesting areas in that space. Before we go, I know we've already at 30 minutes here. We've got about another 15 minutes or so. But I wanted to get into Interstellar, of course, because I love that movie. It's probably easily top three for me science fiction movies. I wanted to play a minute of the visuals that are incredible, and then, you know, we can talk about the movie in general. It's great. I just love it. The visuals there are just so great. And I think talking about the things that Interstellar gets right, the first thing that I thought was fascinating was the theory of relativity and how time works different on the planet versus, you know, when they go down to the planet, how time moves. We know that that is true now, and that is how it works. You know, what, besides everything visually, like the lighting and space, they were very great about keeping it true. Like there's one light source, it's the sun or whatever. There's just so many things that are done perfectly. And what jumps out to you that you're like, I love that, that they get this right.
So going back to the barroom conversation with a bunch of PhDs at a table, I feel like Interstellar and the movie The Martian gets brought up constantly. One of my second favorite questions that I love asking the team is, what are some of the coolest things that the University of Minnesota invented that doesn't get a lot of, you know, discussion? And the thing that they bring up over and over again is the James Webb telescope. You know, if you're my generation, remember the Hubble telescope? Now you're talking about James Webb telescope. That is orders of magnitude more powerful. I am smart enough to know where I'm dumb. And the thing about Interstellar is it is so based on real scientific theory, but I'll even go to a quasi science fiction movie, but there was a great film called Hidden Figures. And one of the things, so it's basically about, you know, the kind of the early Gemini, you know, missions and everything else. What is discussed though amongst PhDs is the James Webb telescope is challenging some theories. We're talking about that. Go back to Einstein, you know, but a lot of the movies predicated on Einstein's theory of relativity. When you get into space, the theories, the equations don't work the same. And that was kind of one of the premise of Hidden Figures, is that they were trying to figure out, okay, how do you get the, you know, launch window right? Because the formulas aren't working. And that is... And so what they were basically talking about, they're like, almost every day, certainly every week, there are additional modifications to existing theories because they're able to kind of measure things in different ways. And so I think
that's, you know, fascinating.
So what's going to be interesting is to see how Interstellar 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, or 30 years from now, just like we talked about Tron, just like we talked about Gattaca, how much did they get right? And then how much of the new theories would they say, yeah, but now you have to consider this, this, and this.
So. Yeah. No, that's interesting. That's fascinating. I really like that in Interstellar, besides the fact you have the father-daughter relationship, I have two daughters. So I mentioned you had a daughter as well. So I love that, any kind of father-daughter stuff. I love that. But the other thing was, what was fascinating to me is at the very beginning, he's talking to the school, and the school is telling him that, well, we now know that we didn't really land on the moon, that was Soviet propaganda. That was propaganda. and it kind of ties back to AI and who's controlling our history and our history books, and how, you know, I do worry at some point where there's no physical copy of information anymore. And we don't have physical books of this is what happened. And we have these photographs that are here in my hand, something tangible. you know, the Interstellar explored that idea of, well, if the AI is our only source of data and somehow that gets corrupted, then, you know, then bad information will be taught as the new history. And that one little nugget there I thought was really interesting.
You take Ben Kingsley's character from the movie Sneakers, right?
Yeah.
And that was all about hacking, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And the main antagonist in the film makes the comment, it's about who controls the information.
Yes.
That is the most important thing. So,
and that's a great movie, by the way.
You could argue sci-fi, you could argue, you know, practical, but
yeah.
You know, I think to draw the connection of with Interstellar, you're exactly right. Even the best AI systems today, and boy, you don't have to Google very hard on this one, are those. So one of the most laborious things for any attorney is basically looking up case law. And yes. you mentioned earlier, like, the implications of AI having essentially phantom data.
Yeah, but hallucinations. They call it hallucinations. Yeah,
exactly. So, like, you and I could talk about hallucinations all night long. You have attorneys across the United States that are either facing censure or disbarment or certainly other kind of problems because they are going in front of the judge presenting cases that don't exist. And then, you know, but if you're attesting to the fact that this information is accurate, you know, even the best AI models today, they'll look you straight in the eye and say, it's still going to be off by about 5 to 10%. Now, different iterations will get it more and more accurate, but that's when it's working properly. And yeah. If you have people that are using nefarious means in terms of manipulating the data to ask for different outcomes, like changing history, I mean, how is that any different from Copernicus going, I don't think this Earth is center and everyone is, I think we're going around the sun.
Right.
And he makes that observation for centuries. You know, you have the church and several others like saying you're wrong. And it wasn't until much later, centuries later. So, you know, I think what I'm basically hoping as we're getting close to the end of this call or this meeting is to say, if sci-fi is a harbinger of anything, we need to continue to explore the bounds of what are the implications if this technology is either used rightly or wrongly, or, you know, what do we do today to potentially protect negative outcomes in the future? And, you know, I guess the good news is because I have a teenage daughter, you know, who loves the genre, like they continue to make, you know, more and more things that are making people think in these different ways. But, you know, if these signposts along the way, you know, we continue to blow by them, then we will have these negative outcomes that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. That's one of the things I love about science fiction is it is a great way for us to explore ideas and talk about possible peril and conflicts that we can get ourselves into. And then also talk about the wonderful things that can happen because it is also entirely feasible that we will have an AI model that has all the medical information ever been made and is the smartest person on the planet when it comes to medical and can invent new cures for new things. That's entirely feasible as well, that it will be an AI model that cures cancer, that it'll be an AI model that cures Alzheimer's. That's possible as well. And so, but along the way, it could also do some damage. And so it's going to be interesting, I think, to see how that happens. I hope there's more science fiction that writes it. I always thought a great premise for a science fiction movie or series would be if science fiction is feeding us all of our news, our video, our data, and that's where we're getting it, some quantum-powered AI engine. One source that gives us it all. If it customizes everything you see for you, and everyone thinks they're getting the same information as everyone else, but they're not, they're getting edited information to produce you to do a certain thing, we would not know any different, right? If we were having a video call, but you aren't real, you're actually generated, right? I would have no way of knowing that. Right. And so you could, you know, and I think we need to talk more about that, because I think there is a real danger of that kind of risk, you know, doing harm.
Yeah. Maybe to kind of go off on a positive, yeah, right? And maybe to also connect some of the films that we talked about, you know, movies like Interstellar. I do have to give a shout out to Dr. Shaul Hannity, you know, former chair of the physics department, stepping down at the University of Minnesota. He indulges me when I ask him these questions every year. And this last year, I asked him the same question, which is, again, one of some of the coolest things that, you know, that the university invented. And he kind of stopped this last year and he said, you know, I have a good friend of mine that's in the neuroscience department at the University of Minnesota, right? And he's like, so much of my life and my career has been looking at the stars, you know, studying wavelengths. Like, there is a new world being discovered when you talk about biophysics.
Okay.
And, you know, Fibonacci had it right all along, which is some of the equations, some of the things that they've looked at and have documented in terms of studying stars, they're discovering it's the same thing with the human brain.
Okay.
So in terms of how the same type of energy currents that are in your brain and how they function is very similar to how the stars work. And so if you understand the wavelengths and electricity of your brain, then when you have a problem like Parkinson's, now you have the ability to essentially, which is basically just breaking the connections. If you can make those connections and you can essentially rebuild that in whatever modality you can do it, now you actually have a cure for these things. But the science behind it comes from studying the stars.
Wow. That's fascinating. I just sat
there looking at him.
That is fascinating.
I can't even begin to tell you the science behind it because it's orders of magnitude outside of
it. Right. Way smarter than me. Yeah.
That level of proper physics, and you're like, this is why we need to continue to look into this. And, you know, this is also why it's like we talked about some of the negative implications, but I think these are good examples of some of the positive ones that are
absolutely
knocking on the door.
Let's go on to one more topic before we wrap it up, if you don't mind, because I think you brought up something really great. When we get into quantum physics, and again, I'm not a scientist, I'm a dumb movie guy, but I love reading about, you know, quantum mechanics and quantum physics and how there's, you know, two protons or electrons can be entangled and be adjusted over any time and space, things like that. Have you read anything about that or just talked with any of your folks about that? Because I think when you get into that area of science fiction, a lot of the things that have been done in the past seem so far out in the realm of not even being possible. But now with what we're learning about quantum physics, a lot of it becomes more possible, multiple universes, multiple worlds, things happening faster than the speed of light. Anything on that front that's come across your desk that's interesting?
So the professor that actually got me on the board at the University of Minnesota was a gentleman named Dr. Marvin Marshak, right? Brilliant physicist. His life in so many ways, and that's probably a separate podcast, it could probably be his own physics version of Forrest Gump. Like, he's just had so many funny interactions with world leaders and other things. But one of his areas of research was basically testing Einstein's theory around proton decay.
Okay.
And, you know, we're talking about stuff that it puts him on the radar of, you know, the Nobel Prize. And you're absolutely bang on in terms of, you know, we're talking about AI today, but the reality is the research around quantum computing it's already there. I mean, it's science fact right now that, you know, your laptop right now or whatever tablet or, you know, like in the next couple of years, you probably need to throw it away like a 486, you know, IBM back in the day, talking about the 80s. Because, I need the quantum chip, right? Yep. It is rewriting not just things like Einstein's theories, but to be more accurate, it's building off of what you just talked about, which is if you're now able to understand a little bit more specifically around where protons are going to be and how they decay and whatever, now you're talking about different areas of math and science that, you know, truly can be that next big leap forward. And it, yeah. and it can't be understated. And that's coming from a guy that probably knows that much in terms of,
right.
but it is definitely one of those things that when you get a room full of PhDs in a room and you get talking about yeah. this exact thing, what used to be, you know, science fiction, like a transporter from Star Trek. Now they're able to actually do that. Granted, it's at a proton level, but
right.
You know,
that's
much
first
more
step.
Science is it yeah, exactly when you yeah. can actually now start bringing things over. Like,
yeah.
you know, we almost went full circle to that whole, you know, Tron video that you showed, which is
yep.
if you're now able to essentially digitize human beings,
right.
You know, he went into a computer, but how is it any different from going from Minnesota to China or any place in between or
right.
the moon?
It's fascinating. So. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Dan. I really appreciate it. This has been a fun conversation. You know, I really enjoyed our talk. I love talking about the science side of sci-fi movies. So, you know, thanks for coming on. Is there anything you wanted to talk about before we go or anything you wanted to tell people to go check out?
You know, here's what I will tell you, which is when you first reached out to me, I just have to thank you so much. Like, this is such a labor of love to talk about this stuff. People that know me know that this is a genre that I really love. And I guess unexpectedly, I'm doing my best to try to pass this on to my daughter. This, as you know, with teenagers and anything else, the best you can do is maybe set the stage.
Right.
So I love this topic. I love the fact that we're kind of connecting science fiction to science reality and then kind of where it's going. This has been a great, fun experience. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. All right. Well, you guys, you know, you guys at home, keep watching your sci-fi and fantasy movies and keep the vision for progress and future going. And we'll see you next time. Thank you.